You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 207.
On today's show, we talk about shipworms, head lice, and kraken skulls.
Let's dig a little deeper into your brain with that. I don't know what kind of weapon we used, but we'll find out in the third segment.
Not shipworms, though.
Oh, yeah, not with shipworms. That's gross.
No.
Nope.
Nope.
Welcome to the show, everybody. Rachel, how's it going?
It's good. This feels weird because we missed a week. So I'm like, man.
Yeah. I hope you guys enjoyed that episode last week. It was really fun hearing the episode that I recorded with Paul, because it's some really cool stuff they're doing out there.
Yeah, definitely. We had been talking about like maybe having Paul on the podcast, and then when you got sick, it just was perfect to just, you know, play your conversation with him. I wasn't there, but that's fine. I didn't need to be there.
Yeah, and I'm still getting over a little bit of a cough, so you won't know it, but I might be doing some heavy editing on this today.
Yeah, whenever the finger comes up at me across the desk, I know that means to stop talking so that you can cough.
Yeah, the first finger.
Yeah.
Other fingers mean other things.
Wait, I don't know what you're... No, gross. All don't do that. Anyway.
So anyway, we are just our little life update that we like to do. We're down here in Mexico still, and we actually decided to stay another month.
We did.
Yeah.
It's very affordable here and it's beautiful. And I guess it's like Snowmageddon up north of here or something. So like, don't need to do that.
When you see a dusting of snow on the Hollywood sign, you know, it's time to not go north again.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Nope. No, thank you.
Anyway, we've got a handful of news articles to talk about this week. And the first one is from Newsweek's Tech and Science Division, published on February 16th. And it's called Wreck of Ship Lost to Storm 139 Years Ago Washes Up on a Massachusetts Beach. And I'm just thinking, there are probably, like, how does a wreck from X number of years ago not wash up on a Massachusetts beach every year?
Yeah, I mean, you know what? It probably does. I feel like we have covered a lot of uncovered wrecks. But this one I wanted to talk about because this isn't the first fragments from this boat that have washed up here.
Mm-hmm.
There was actually some fragments back in December too, and we kind of missed covering the story back then when it came out because we were doing other things. And so I thought this would be a good moment to talk about it because it's a cool wreck.
Yeah, and in the article they actually have a pretty cool video right at the top of the page there that's kind of showing the wreck.
Yeah, it's really neat. So basically there's these wooden boat fragments. They appear on this beach in Nantucket. And Dave Robinson, who is head of the Massachusetts Board of Underwater Archaeological Resources,
fancy.
He has confirmed that it was likely a section of the renowned ship that wrecked nearby, the Warren Sawyer.
I mean, how does he know that? Does it say in the article? I can't remember.
It doesn't say, however, because those fragments had washed up back in December, too. I think they've already done some research here, and whatever pieces these were very obviously part of that same wreck is what I understand anyway.
Yeah.
So the Warren Sawyer was a schooner that wrecked on the Mayakamet Beach in December of 1884. It was blown off course by severe winds while it was traveling from New Orleans to Boston. And
it was carrying a whole bunch of tea, right?
No, that would be a century earlier. No. Oh,
yeah. No, this one was carrying this one was carrying a cargo of cotton and scrap iron.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, man, God, scrap iron on a boat.
Yeah.
That's heavy.
Yeah. I'm sure it was very heavy.
Displaced by the cotton, though, I guess.
Yeah. But cotton gets real heavy, too, when you get a whole pile of it. Like, it's, you know, think about a stack of fabric that it gets heavy. So, anyway, the ship was destroyed, obviously, and the cargo was lost. But silver lining, I suppose, is that the crew all made it ashore alive. So it's not one of those kind of tragic wrecks.
Yeah, and I don't know if anybody's ever read Moby Dick. I read it a few years ago, actually.
Yeah.
Actually, it's probably closer to like 8 or 9 years
ago
at this
point.
Ago.
Yeah.
It was when we lived up in Sparks, I think, Nevada. But anyway, Herman Melville based his book Moby Dick on the Nantucket whaling industry, which anybody who's read that would be obvious. But and that was all dominant during this time period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's just a lot of boat activity going on in this area for sure at that time period.
Yeah.
So the fragments have been very well preserved so far. And this is the main reason why I thought it would be fun to cover this story, because it's like, why are some ships really well preserved and why are others just like husks that you can't even find anything of that fall apart. One reason why a ship might be well preserved and is the case in this particular situation is that after it sank, it was quickly covered in sediment on the bottom of the ocean. And that like layer of sediment when it's in the ocean, yeah, is what allowed it to be preserved and just kind of stay there. And mm-hmm, it's almost the same condition it was when it sank. So that's really cool.
That's kind of the, fortunate thing about shipwrecks is, mm-hmm, they often happen in storms, and storms are turbulent times. And the closer you are to shallower waters, mm-hmm, or I guess the shallower water that you're in, the more that sediment is being turned up by the tumultuousness, mm-hmm, of the ocean and the currents that are being created. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's probably a little loose down there anyway.
Yeah.
And then when it's all just being tossed around and after the storm settles, it gets,
you're just buried.
Up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what happens, this I thought was so cool. What happens if you're not, if the ship sinks and it's not covered in sediment, mm-hmm, is there are certain little critters that will get in there and start eating.
Always a little critter.
I know, there's always a critter. So there's these things called teredo worms, and they just like think that timber is delicious.
Yeah.
And they just get in there and start eating it. And you can see, if you see a picture of wood that's been underwater that has like those little like wavy lines in it, that's from these like worms like boring their way in and just like eating their way through the wood.
If you, at this point, do not think evolution is an actual biological process, just think about the fact that whatever substance has been created, including things we've made like plastic, there are organisms that will eat and digest plastic.
Uh-huh.
Little, small, tiny microorganisms that have been maybe even developed. I'm not really sure. And yeah, they will just eat anything that you want. Mm-hmm. And there's, bacteria that eats poop.
There's something to eat everything.
There's bacteria, yeah, and organisms to eat wood. I just heard last night around the campfire that somebody has discovered and or is developing this little larvae of something that eats goat heads. If you don't know what goat head is, it's a tiny little sticky thing that is like prickly and gets in your feet in certain parts of the United States and, uh-huh, probably Mexico and other places of the world.
Yeah.
But there's this thing that eats them and will just like break them down.
What?
So they know. And I'm like, okay,
really?
But what are we growing that's eating goat heads? Like, what are we propagating there?
Yeah.
So anyway, there's something to eat everything.
There is something to eat everything,
and
for sure.
It's actually a big concern with this because in all archaeology, because again, there is something to eat anything,
mm-hmm,
and you have to think about that when it comes to preservation. You,
yeah,
know, when you take it out of that environment, is there something else that's going to think it's delicious? So when you take it out of whatever protective, mm-hmm, environment it's in now,
yeah,
how are you going to protect that? And they have to inject like wood beams and ship and stuff with certain materials, mm-hmm, in order to preserve them. Because the minute they expose them to the open air, they start to degrade.
Yeah, they start degrading
and
for
then,
sure.
And then there's other stuff that will think,
yeah,
it's delicious.
Yeah, it's like there's always something that will,
yeah,
come after a ship that has sunk.
Yeah.
You know, if it's underwater and it's not buried in sediment, these shipworms are going to eat it. Once it's exposed to the air, yeah, is going to degrade it. So like there's always something that is trying to decompose the ship. So
yeah,
archaeologists definitely have to act fast in these scenarios in order to learn what we can from them before they're gone.
And in fact, this article is little about the ship and mostly about ship-eating worms.
It really is, but
yeah,
they are very interesting because, like, we really dodged a bullet with this wreck in particular because, you know, had it been not as well buried in sediments, then,
yeah,
then these shipworms, the Teredo nivalis, would have, you know, eaten them.
Yeah.
They're like these little, it's actually, they call them worms, but they're actually like a little clam species that just sort of bore their way in there and eat. This is disgusting too. They can grow up to 20 inches long.
Nope.
And they will completely devour anything in the water made of wood. And that can include ship hulls, sunken ships, docks, piers, seawalls, anything, anything.
Big pile of nope.
Yeah, I know, it's so crazy. And as you can imagine, these were particularly devastating in the era where everything was made of wood, you know, like pre-1900s-ish, that everything was wood back then, you know?
Yeah. Of course, the British Royal Navy wasn't going to have any of it. That wasn't sophisticated enough for them. That worms were eating their ships.
No, they couldn't,
yeah,
have that.
So they tried covering their hulls in copper,
yeah,
or at least strategically covering them in copper to protect them.
Yeah, it didn't. I think that worked to some extent, but of course it's not perfect either, because you know what? You put metal in water and what happens?
It rusts.
It rusts, or there's underwater bacteria that will, you know, eat that. So there's just so much to eat ships You talk about like moving onto a boat someday, and I'm like, the ocean is just constantly trying to destroy your boat. Your boat. That's all it wants to do is destroy the boat.
Fiberglass, however, is one of the few things that there's almost nothing will eat that, you know, which kind of makes you think about
that's true.
Your own life living on fiberglass. But either way, yeah.
Yeah.
So
anyway, so all that's to say is that there's a lot of things that want to eat the wood. Yeah. So we've got this great preservation because of the sediment. And like you said before, it's, you know, the shifting ocean floor and storm surges will bury the ship, but then it's also what exposes the ship. Yeah. And then the waves push it to shore, obviously, once it is uncovered, because if it's not buried and anchored to the bottom, then it's just going to roll on in.
Yeah. And if we don't get to it quickly, it can start decomposing, like we said earlier.
Yeah.
Once it gets exposed to the air, it's no longer, so to speak, protected by water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, water will degrade it in its own way, and probably over time it'll just be gone anyway.
Yeah.
But it's much quicker when it gets exposed to the air.
When it starts drying out, like that's when it goes. So,
and not only that, but it will start warping and deforming and you won't see its kind of original shape anymore. Not that it necessarily has its original shape in the water either, because it will kind of inflate and balloon up as it gets waterlogged, but still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in this case, experts were contacted very quickly, and also they knew what ship they were dealing with, too, because of the previous fragments that had washed up. So in this case, you know, conservation efforts were able to begin quickly, and they knew, I mean, it really is just like piles of wood. So like in the end, I'm not really sure how much they can learn from that, but at least whatever they could learn, they started it quickly and they got it done. It's not always the case when a ship is washed ashore, a shipwreck, and then is not found right away. Like in that case, you're going to lose that time. So,
yeah. And the cool thing is, you know, when they recover this wood, they can start to get an idea of the age of the wood, at least when it was cut down.
Yeah.
Using dendrochronology, because we have really good dendrochronological records around the world that people have put together these lists. And essentially, if we haven't talked about this in a while, dendrochronology is the science of essentially counting tree rings.
Mm-hmm.
And not only counting tree rings, but looking at the thickness of the tree rings to, you know, sort of match it up with other climatological cycles. So if you have a really thick tree ring, it was a good year for growth on that tree. So whatever that means for that tree and its environment, you can kind of match that up with other climatological data, sea core, you know, lake core sediments, stuff like that. But once you get this profile, you can look at this log. Now that's just when it was cut. There's nothing saying it didn't sit in a shipyard for 30 years and not get used on an actual boat, you know, but at least we can say when it was cut, which should be pretty close to when the ship was built.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool.
And also where too, right? Because you've got different species of wood. So, you know, if in this case they knew which ship it was, but if you have a shipwreck that washes up and you have zero idea where it is, where it came from, when it is, any of that, you use the dendrochronology not only for the dating, but also for the, at least where the wood species is from, which might help you narrow in on which ship it is, because I think we have fairly decent records of what ships wrecked when, because merchants, you know, they did a good job of tracking what happened with their boats. And also like the armies or navy and stuff too would be doing a good job of tracking what sank and when and where. So you can figure that out.
Our brains just want to keep a log when it comes to boats for whatever reason. I mean, even people that live privately on sailboats and things like that, I mean, they always keep a log.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you don't keep a log. I don't keep a log in the RV. I mean, I do when we travel, which is mileage and stuff, but that's more for taxes than anything.
Mm-hmm.
But it's crazy.
Yeah. So, we always seem to have pretty good information about what ship it could be.
Yeah.
And then you can narrow it down from there. So.
Yeah. So between the log, the dendrochronology, you can start to untangle where this ship came from, much like our next article untangles the alphabet. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 207. We're talking about some news articles today, and this next one is a real head scratcher.
I did not see that coming.
How did that happen?
I'm about to take a sip of coffee. I almost spit it. Oh my God.
Go ahead and sip your coffee. It's from Smithsonian Magazine. Published on actually November 10th, so it's not actually from this this month or this week, but it was still pretty interesting. And we've been seeing it for a couple of weeks now and just wanted to talk about it. But it's scientists translate the oldest sentence written in the first alphabet, and it's inscribed on a Canaanite comb, and the words reveal a struggle with head lice.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So yeah, it's a tiny ivory comb. The words read, "May this tusk root out the lice of the hair and the beard."
I know, that sounds awful.
I know, it really does.
Anytime you're like, oh, I want to be so, it would be so romantic to just go back in time to these time periods and like yeah, you better.
Then there's all of this.
You're gonna poop in a hole every day and it's going to be bad because you won't understand the food. There's no water. You'll have to drink beer all the time
yeah,
and wine.
Yeah.
And you'll have head lice.
Yeah. It doesn't sound great in some ways.
I don't know how we survived it as
yeah,
people.
I just remember like, I'm sure you had this experience too. I think everybody did as a kid where like somebody in your classroom got lice and then like, everybody had to like go through like the lice check
yeah,
and we had like vinegar shampoo and stuff that we had to use. It was so gross.
I've been through the lice checks, but I don't ever remember getting it.
No, I never got it. I never did either. It was just, it became like a thing that you had to check because somebody in your classroom had it and it spreads.
Is that still a
so
thing
easily.
In school? I don't even know.
I don't know.
I don't have kids.
Yeah. I don't know if kids still get lice or not, but
I mean, it's not like our hygiene was so poor in the 80s. That,
no,
you know,
I know. It's not that
so
much
so like
different.
Where would it have gone?
Right.
But,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Anyway. The language, like we said, is in Canaanite, and the Canaanites were a group that lived in modern day Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Israel, and Palestine from approximately 3500 to 1150 BCE.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the comb was found in 2016 from Israeli archaeological site
Lachish. Or Lachish. I don't know if you pronounce the CH.
Lachish.
Yeah. The letters were actually overlooked because they look like, I mean, honestly,
like
you can see it because
almost.
You know there's letters.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it looks like just scratches on there that are kind of random. But they were overlooked until they were taking photos in 2021 and then saw them while zooming in.
Yeah, and probably had better light and they could like use the shadow to really pick out what they were seeing.
Yeah.
There are clusters of Canaanite letters that have been found on other artifacts like pottery, sherds, and projectile points.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the first time an actual like complete sentence has been found. And that is important because the Canaanite alphabet is one of the earliest ones. It was developed approximately 3,800 years ago, and it became the foundation for ancient Greek and Latin.
Yeah. The comb measures less than 1.5 inches wide and 1 inch high. I'm guessing there's a lot more to it. And this is just a fragment.
Well, I don't know. You can, if you look at the pictures, it looks like edges. I think it was just a small, it was meant for picking out lice. It wasn't necessarily meant for detangling, I think, right?
Again, it's just making my head scratch.
Yeah.
My head itch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's made of ivory, which would have made it a little more valuable import to the area because they didn't have like a ready source of ivory.
Yeah,
but of course, that was back when we would just take ivory off the faces of animals and use it for our own purposes.
Yes, but I don't think there's any animal, there's no elephants or anything that,
not that I'm
in
aware
that
of.
Area. So I think it would have definitely been an import or a trade situation that got the comb.
Or at least not ones with tusks.
Yeah, exactly. On one side of the comb, it has 6 thick teeth that were probably used for like not untangling. Also, you know, maybe it was used as an actual comb then because that, you know, I mean, only 1 inch, but I guess maybe that's enough to get your beard untangled or whatever.
Right.
And then on the other side of the comb, it has 14 finer teeth.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a double sided situation going on for all of your lice and detangling needs.
Yeah. The odd thing when you look at the picture is I didn't actually notice until we read that it had 6 teeth, 6 thick teeth, because that's on the top of the photograph in the article. And I'm going to say it just looks like little stubs.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they have other examples to this to confirm that those really were longer things. And that's, or is that just conjecture to say that these were longer pieces over here because they look like the ones down here, but thicker.
Yeah. Well, so, like what else would those stubs be though?
I don't know.
I guess it could be part of decoration maybe, but it,
who knows, right?
Based on how equally they're sorted out. And there's a couple of them in the picture. You can see they really are like little stumps coming up off the top. So it would make the most sense that they were thicker teeth on that side. But yeah, they are gone. They're mostly broken off. So you can't really say for sure what was going on there.
Yeah. Interesting thing is you can carbon date ivory because it's organic.
Yeah.
You know, it's it doesn't seem like it. It seems like, feels like rock.
Yeah. But, right.
But it's definitely organic. It's like teeth basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not really. It's not the same thing as
teeth.
No,
but it's like a similar substance.
But that failed for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And but the site it was found on, other dates were found that ranged from 1700 to 1550 BCE.
Yeah.
I'm kind of surprised with the development of language in this area being well before that, that this is the first time we've found like a complete sentence in that language.
Yeah, totally.
That's just mind-boggling to me. Why don't we have other examples of that?
Yeah, well, maybe they whatever they were putting the sentences on is probably something mm-hmm. that doesn't preserve, right?
Yeah.
So we just don't have the things with inscriptions.
But they were carving stuff in all kinds of things.
Yeah,
I mean, they have an ivory carved comb here. So,
yeah, right.
You know, it's just, it's crazy. And well, mm-hmm. you know, the thing is, this was found 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So what other kind of stuff is sitting in a box somewhere that has writing on it that's mm-hmm. older or from the same time period? And we just don't know anything about it.
Yeah. Know? It's the thing that we talk about all the time, that you don't know to look for something until you know to look for it,
yeah.
right? And this sort of inscription that is really hard to see and might not look like inscription until you get a microscope on it or a really zoomed in lens, then, you know, it's worth like a reevaluation of any artifacts that might have this kind of thing on them. But then again, who would have thought a comb would have an inscription on it? That is such a strange artifact to have words on it. And yet here it is. So you really never know what you're going to find. And this is definitely like a really, really special, special artifact. I don't usually, and we try to be careful about not like revering artifacts, right? Because artifacts are just this tiny little piece of the culture that they represent. And what you should be trying to do is learn about and understand the culture that they mm-hmm. come from, and not just hyper value the things that they made. But in this case, it is such a really special artifact that it is worth, you know, valuing and also learning from. So it's cool.
I just imagine a future where we've got intelligent, nimble fingered robots, basically, because robots are coming around. There's robots in every industry, just about mm-hmm. In one way, shape or another. And I just imagine unleashing an army of robots into a lab or an archive, basically, mm-hmm. and just having them go through and, you know, clean and and just reanalyze. They could probably have eyes that could do photogrammetry, and they could just, you know, do a thing and upload it as they're doing it. And just all the things we're going to learn in these freaking museum collections that were collected even, you know, a few years ago to decades and decades and decades ago. And who knows what's lurking in our own collections already?
Yeah, I mean, it's another thing that we've talked about before in our own experience with archaeology, is that there's like the whole drudgery aspect of it.
Yeah.
Where you're just like wading through piles of artifacts and data trying to make sense out of it. But if you can have AI or robots or whatever come in and do that first pass for you, so that you miss that soul crushing, you know, thing where you have to sit in a lab and look at artifacts all day long, and most of them are nothing. But if AI could do that first pass for you, you don't have to do it. It would be great.
And there's any number of grad students and undergrads and work study students that would be happy just getting a meager paycheck to sit in a lab and just reanalyze stuff. But there really is no time or budget for any of that.
Yeah.
And honestly, if I had to do it, I would probably want to smash my skull in with an ancient weapon. We'll talk about that on the other side of the break.
That was a good one.
Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 207. And as I mentioned, we're going to talk about smashing skulls.
Yes.
Smashing skulls and ancient murders. So this is the true crime version of the podcast.
Oh, my God.
And yeah, and it really kind of is, right? It's the true ancient crime. We've talked about doing like a true crime podcast about ancient murders and things like that. This will be a perfect article to talk about. In that case, although it's not like a specific murder like you're used to in real true crime podcasts, that's usually what they talk about is, oh, when, you know, young Jennifer was murdered, let's talk about that. Mm-hmm. Right. But this is a little bit different. And that's how an archaeology true crime podcast would have to be in most cases, because if we know who was murdered, chances are we like know who did it.
Yeah.
And we know how it happened.
Yeah.
Because they're famous. Right. And it was written about.
True.
So
very
but
true.
Most of the potential murders that we would talk about, or we've actually probably found in the field, because one of the first projects we worked on together, there were a lot of human remains. And I have no doubt that some of those people could have been murdered.
They could have been.
Right. Yeah. But we would just never really know that unless there was real evidence for it, which is what the point of this article is. Mm-hmm. And we're actually, for this one, we found the original publication. So you can look at the journal article. Mm-hmm. And then also the one we're talking about is from the Kansas City Star, February 25th. 2023, and it's called Scientists Smash Skulls with Stone Age Weapons to Solve Ancient Murders.
Yeah, so this is a little bit of a experimental archaeology kind of a situation, too, in a way that I have never heard of it being used before.
Yeah, so for sure.
It's cool.
Yeah, the data set they were using is from an archaeological site that goes back to 2006, when a mass grave was found by archaeologists in Germany. and contained 26 individuals that had signs of extreme trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Extreme trauma. Not just like to their heads either, but like to other parts
like
of their
whole bodies. Yeah. Yeah. And the graves date to about 7,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was called the Talheim Death Pit.
Yeah, that's not ominous at all.
No, I know. And like you said, like the bodies were just like smashed, legs broken, and yeah, probably tortured, right? Like it must have been tortured.
I mean, listen, 7,000 years ago, if I'm like with my family and I'm coming across the German countryside and I'm like, let's go to the Talheim Death Pit. I'm like, why would we go there? We're just going to get our head smashed in.
Yeah.
No, that's obviously not the old name of it.
Right.
Yeah. So again, 7,000 years ago, this was during the Middle Neolithic or Stone Age. And that time period started around 10,000 years ago. It's a really long time period.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows a type of violence that was apparently common in that area, because we have, this is not the first example of this.
Right.
You know, it's just a mass grave, which I don't know how many mass graves there are, but there's definitely evidence of pretty severe violence in the past with some other graves.
And it's interesting because it's kind of like, why? Because if you're a conquering, you know, tribe or group or whatever coming into an area and you feel the need to murder all of the people so that you can claim that territory for yourself. Okay, fine. I'm sure that happened. But like, why the torture aspect of it? Like, what would you be getting out of that? Why would that happen?
And it may not have been, I don't know if torture is the right word, to be honest with you. I think it was
extreme violence.
Extreme violence.
Looks like it was torture, but it was.
Yeah. And then you get somebody on your knees. You've already hit once. You're going to hit them one more time to take them out. Right.
I know. So,
I don't know why. People,
it's so hard for me to understand why.
I don't know why the people back then were so angry, but you are talking about people that came out of the last ice age, and they came out of the last ice age with very few resources, trying to figure out how to survive. Now, that was a few thousand years before this, but you know, as they're coming out of that 7,000 years ago, the environment's changing, the animals are changing, the, you know, everything is in, you know, constant flux historically. I mean, from the day to day, it probably didn't look like that to them.
Right.
But it seemed like for thousands of years, it was probably a constant struggle for resources.
Yeah.
And trying to figure that out. And you just start to probably just get real angry at people who want your food.
Yeah. And, you know, violence just becomes a part of your daily life.
That's
just how
it was.
Yeah. It is hard from a modern mindset to understand why, but it probably was all down to resources, right?
Yeah. So this study wanted to figure out exactly how they were killed and what weapons were used, right? Mm-hmm. Because you can see smashed skulls, but what does that mean? Do they use rock? Do they fall down a cliff? Like, what happened, right?
Yeah.
So they created similar stone tools, including an axe with a maple handle and a stone of serpentine rock, it's called. We've seen serpentine actually in Nevada, I think.
Oh, have we?
And,
okay.
It's a kind of chert, similar to flint, they call it. Flint is a kind of chert that's over common in Europe. There's flint here, too, in the United States. But it's flint is the kind of stuff that is on the end of a hammer strike for an old style of gun.
Make a spark, basically, right?
Yeah.
The second weapon was based on a different murder victim from Spain found in 1999. That victim was killed using a stone adze, which is basically a big pointed rock sharpened and then tied to a stick.
Yeah.
That's kind of like what you see in the movies, right? That's what cavemen are running around with.
Pretty much the tomahawk style, sort of.
Yeah.
But anyway, the reason they went to this other site in Spain is because they wanted something that was definitive. They knew that that dude was killed with this type of a tool. So they knew what that looked like. And those types of tools were available in Germany at this time as well.
Mm-hmm.
It, not what became Germany,
right?
The Neolithic Germany area. So they wanted to have not necessarily a control, but kind of a control, you know, to see what was going on here. So they ended up creating skulls out of polyurethane, gelatin, and rubber skin. They were very realistic.
Okay. Yeah.
And would exhibit the same like fracture mechanics
that real bone would, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the scientists basically just started taking swings at them.
So they made actual skulls.
Yeah.
So they were shaped like human skulls and everything, like all the same pieces, all of that.
Yeah. And then just raged on them.
Oh, man. I feel like that would be hard to do, too. I mean, all in the name of science, I suppose. But geez.
I know. They said the skulls crunched when smashed and left behind telltale signs.
Yeah, I'm sure they did.
Each tool would would interact with the skull in a different way, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And since they had like the rubberized portion on there that represented the skin, because you really need the skin around the skull to understand how it's going to fracture, because the skin
holds it together.
The skin can not only hold it together, yeah. but, you know, possibly cause a glance off and cause different uh-huh. kinds of things to happen. So
yeah, definitely.
Yeah. A different tool would, or weapon, I guess, in this case, would, you know, interact with that in a different way. Mm-hmm. Some would be yeah. more effective than others.
Incidentally, that's how like forensic anthropologists and physical anthropologists can look at a skull, and when they see damage to a skull, they can look at it and figure out whether it happened, you know, while the person was still alive and or after death. Because yeah. like you said, like if it's just a skull that has decomposed just down to the bone mm-hmm. and then damage happens to it, like it falls off of a cliff or, yeah. you know, a mountain lion drags it around, that kind of damage is totally different from what it looks like when there's skin still on the body and mm-hmm. it, even somebody's still alive, you know, that's just very different damage. So that's yeah. a very important key thing to recreate in this experimental archaeology.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They found that the axes and adzes were very similar in what they do to the mm-hmm. skulls, but there were some very definable characteristics that made them look different.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the similarity ended where they both smashed skulls open.
Yeah.
But how they do it was different, right?
Yep.
And one of the cool things is they ultimately determined that the German victims were likely killed with something looked like an adze,
mm-hmm.
right? Because of the shape of the injury.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is the adze is a very heavy rock, very big rock that's very pointed.
Pointed.
Mm-hmm. And because it's so pointed, you can also kind of tell the direction the blow came from.
So would it have been a pointed rock on a stick where the point is in line with the stick, or would it have been like perpendicular?
Still a chopping motion.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So kind of like an axe, the way it's mounted on there with the point coming off of it at right. a 90 degree angle.
Right.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah. So, and in fact, they have pictures in the actual article.
Okay.
If you look at the journal article,
yeah,
the journal article is open access. You can actually download the PDF,
mm-hmm.
but they show these trials where they're trying to smash at these, I guess these kind of round things that aren't really skulls, but you can see the handle that they had and then the thing affixed to it. So they mm-hmm. were both like an axe type of chopping thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So again, tomahawk is Native American, mm-hmm. but it's kind of the thing that comes to my mind because that short handle
yeah.
with the thing on the end of it, you know,
mm-hmm.
so yeah. it's very similar.
Okay.
And I'm sure, I mean, that's just a similar like extension of your arm. And I imagine cultures all over the planet
yeah.
develop something like that.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Slightly different versions of it, slightly different pointy things.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, definitely. It's an easy thing to imagine doing.
Yeah. So the cool thing about the adze damage showing the direction of the attack is that they were also able to reconstruct how some of the victims were killed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty cool. I would imagine you'd be able to tell stuff like, you know, if somebody's told to get on their knees and they were chopped from the top of the head,
oh,
that's hard to do when someone's standing up.
It's true. Yeah.
But then again, could you do that if somebody would like lunged at you and were bent forward and then you hit them on the top of the head with the axe?
Maybe.
You know?
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
But I bet there's a slightly different angle to all of that. And if you have the right preservation, you can probably mm-hmm. tell that depending on, you know, how yeah. well it's preserved, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But take a look at the pictures. It's really good. It's really interesting how these different things left different holes and different shapes of holes. And
mm-hmm.
and I guess I was wrong. They really didn't make skulls. I thought they had. They made these round representations of skulls because they really just wanted to see how the bone reacted
okay.
under skin.
Yeah.
Right. So
that actually, it feels so much better to me because like doing experimental archaeology on exploding things that look like actual human
yeah.
skulls, like the,
you know,
the like mental trauma of that would
yeah.
be hard. So I'm kind of glad they didn't look actually like skulls.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, pretty cool research study and just shows you that, you know, it's not just about smashing heads and taking names, but they really did some good graphics on here and analyzed how each thing did. And they tried to hit these in the same way with the same tool, you know, and
mm-hmm.
I mean, you're probably not doing it with the adrenaline rush of a, you know, a Stone Age man, more than likely,
mm-hmm.
that is just going to come down on you with all its force.
Yeah.
But that being said, you know, you may not need that to be able to tell the different shapes of things.
Yeah, true.
Yeah,
true, true.
So
really cool study.
Anyway, since this kind of trauma is common in this area, they hope to shed light on other discoveries that have been made and maybe mm-hmm. reanalyze some other collections and say, oh yeah, it was this that
mm-hmm.
did it, you know?
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool.
That is really neat.
Well, that's pretty much all we have for today. And besides, we really don't have time anymore because it's, you know, Saturday in Mexico and we're going to go tequila tasting.
So, yep.
You know, that's what you do.
That is the plan for the afternoon. Yep.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, with that, I guess we will see you guys next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, Dig Tech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.